The Inheritors podcast series by Bloomberg Quint.
Welcome to The Inheritors, a podcast series by Bloomberg Quint. I am Sonu Bhaseen, and today I am in conversation with Jaspal Sani, chairman of the Eagle Group. You know, he took the name of his group inspired by one of his business partners, F.C. Mehra. F.C. Mehra used to make films under the banner of Eagle Films. More about that in my conversation with Jaspal. But before we take you there, let me say that Jaspal embodies the spirit of entrepreneurship, or as he calls it, the pioneering spirit. He was the first to import minibars for hotels in India. He was the first dealer of Scotch Guard in India. And he continues to be a partner in the iconic Plaza Cinema of Delhi. Let me warn you, Jaspal is a great storyteller, and I am sure that you will enjoy his stories in the conversation. So let's go straight ahead to the boardroom of his office in Delhi and start the conversation. So hi, Jaspal. Lovely to have you on the podcast, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Thank you, Sonu. Nice of you to drop in, and what do you really wish to talk about?
You know what? Since we have talked before, your story is actually quite incredible. And, you know, the way that your family came from Pakistan with actually nothing, and how the family built its business and how you yourself built the business. I think it's a fascinating story. So why don't you just take us through how the family moved from Pakistan to India, to Delhi, you know, during the partition days. And let's just start from there.
Okay, so now what I'm really looking at, well, you're talking about the inheritors. Now, people may find that or think that once you've inherited something, you've got it all and there's nothing you can do wrong and you're made for life. Actually, life is not about that. At every time, what I've seen, that with every generation, with every decade, with every, I would say, 20 years, circumstances change, your journey changes, you've got to improvise, you've got to improve, you've got to take stock of what's happening. You cannot just stick to what you were doing. I always tell everybody, I'm third generation entrepreneur. What my grandfather did, my father did not. What my father did, my elder brother did not. What my elder brother did, I did not. And what I did, my children are not doing the same. So at every point of life, life is dynamic, business is dynamic. Inheritance really gives you a platform, no more, no less. So, as you said, let's start at 1947, or just pre-1947. I think we come from a family which is not afraid to improvise, not afraid to take chances. My grandfather lived in a small village in Pakistan, about 25 kilometers from Rawalpindi. In fact, what I'm told is in those days, even the road was not Pakka, it was a Kacha road.
In Rawalpindi, you mean to say that the road
outside was the Rawalpindi, 25 kilometers, so 25 kilometers of Kacha road. So my grandfather used to, I'm told, run a trading business there in a small village. And he felt that the environment was not big enough for him. So he made the journey to Peshawar, Kent. Peshawar, Kent in those days was bustling with the British. The British had a fairly large cantonment and contingent of army officers. And he first set up shop there and developed something called the Kabadi Market.
Kabadi Market, as we know, the Kabadi Market.
That's absolutely
right.
So he would buy trucks and buses which had done their useful life, dismantle them and sell those parts to people or the serviceable parts to who are wanting it. He found that a good business, and then he invited his friends, family from Peshawar, and he founded the what is called the Kabaddi Bazaar in Peshawar campus.
It still exists, Kabaddi Bazaar?
It still exists, except now it's a jewelry market.
Really? From kabad to jewelry?
That's right. The reason was that at the corner of Kabaddi market, the road was what they called Gora Bazaar. Now, Gora Bazaar was where the British people, they would buy anything and everything. So when my grandfather had made his small capital, he put up or perhaps purchased a four-story building, and he would sell anything and everything what the Goras wanted.
In the Gora market?
That is at the corner of the Gora Bazaar and the Kabaddi market, which today is a jewelry market. In fact, sometime back, about 8-9 years back, I did go back and visit the place. And I was overwhelmed at what I saw.
Yeah.
So my father grew up as a young lad under his father, and he would sell bidet balls and bow ties, saddles, shoes, whatever the Goras really wanted. And even though he was not very good at written English, I don't think he had any formal training of written English, but he was fluent in spoken English because his customers were all the Britishers. So that's where he grew up. And but that's not what he did. He got an opportunity to, he got an opportunity in 1944 or 1945 to run a trucking contract in Iran from Mashhad, which is a small town in Iran, ferrying things to Tehran and back. Tehran, of course, the capital of Iran. Now, how he got that contract is a mystery, because in those days there were no telephones, no televisions, hardly telexes, that means writing letters. So he arrived at Mashhad with a small contingent of trucks and found that the British company which had given him the contract actually didn't exist anymore. They had gone bankrupt.
Right.
So what did he do? He used his powers of improvisation and improvement. He found out who the Gora was, who was instrumental to giving the trucking contract. So he went to the market, purchased, and he was a good Scotch. He's a good lover of Scotch whiskey, and knew that every Britisher loved his bottle of Scotch whiskey. So he went to the market, picked out whichever best quality Scotch he could find, knocked on the major's door, introduced himself, and said that he had a trucking contract from a British company which didn't exist. So I'm told they both sat down, bought down the bottle of whiskey, and he then came away with a contract in his name to do the actual contract which he was supposed to be doing a subcontract for, which actually means he had a bigger margin. So that is the way he took his first large step forward. And my mother intimates to me that in a matter of 4 years, when the World War finished, so actually that means he would have gone to Mashhad in 40, not in 44. That means in 44 he would have finished his money-making spree. My mother tells me that he returned back home with 20 lakhs Indian cash.
Cash.
Which
in the truck.
By train. Well, partly by bus, partly by train. You must remember, Sonu, in those days, 1 rupee equaled $1, which means he had in cash $2 million worth of profit. So you can imagine what he could have done in Peshawar, except in 1947 the partition took place. And whatever we had and whatever he was building with that little fortune in Peshawar got left behind. So he had to move again and improvise, improve in a country which is brand new to him. We didn't have any running business in India, except again through his British contracts he had come to know that there were some disposal dumps, army disposal dumps available in Assam. So since he had quite a bit of cash on him, he could afford to go there and get for the entire lot, which was not possible for everybody. So I'm told what he used to do is bid for the lot, break it down into smaller lots, sell half of it there, carry the rest to Calcutta. Whatever he could sell in Calcutta, he would do the same, balance carried to Delhi. And whatever he couldn't sell in Delhi, he would take back to Peshawar, which was his hometown. So actually, we only had a warehouse in Delhi when the whole Holocaust took place. I was a baby in arms, about 6 months of age, perhaps even 4 or 5 months. Thought this was a short-term problem. And once the two administrations sat down and got down to administering their countries, people could coexist in Pakistan and people could coexist in India, which unfortunately did not turn out to be so. So, what I'm told, they packed baggage for about 10 days, went to Lahore. They found things in Lahore were not any better than Peshawar. They just kept on driving in the car. I think they had two cars at that time. All the way to Delhi. Of course, we didn't have a home in Delhi. So the option was to either go to the camps, which were dirty, filthy, overcrowded. Again, the elders improvised. They found very close to our warehouse, which is on Roshan Road. Fortunately, we still own that property yet. Just opposite, there was a flat on the first floor, which was lying vacant. Vacant as in there were no living people, there were dead people strewn around. Probably some unfortunate Muslim family had got hacked. So the women went around cleaning the floors and the men went around removing the dead bodies, and that's where we moved in to a three-room apartment, not a three-bedroom apartment, a three-room apartment. From a palatial home in Peshawar, Kent, which, as I said, I revisited on 1 acre of land, and I think it should have about 20, 22 bedrooms. Yeah. So we confined ourselves to three rooms.
And how big was the family at that time? How many of you moved in the two cars?
My Tayaji and my grandmother came later because they were very confident that nobody could touch a hair on their body. I mean, they had lived in Peshawar country for literally years. So let's say there would be my Taiji, my mother, father, three children, six, my cousins, another three, nine, and my chachaji.
That 10 people.
So 10 people crowded into a three-room affair, and we lived there until 1953, that means for 7 years, until my father and his elder brother, who ultimately was rescued by the Indian Army in Peshawar, brought back in an army truck. And fortunately, we moved into a palatial home on Bangalore Road, again having 12 bedrooms, and that's where I grew up.
That's where you grew up. So your grandmother and the other person who stayed behind,
Mataji,
who stayed behind,
were rescued
by
the army.
They were able to then come back to
India.
And it's actually quite interesting that you said that people then didn't believe that this was going to last. And they packed only 10, you know, enough stuff for 10 days and they came to India. It must have been traumatic for the family.
I mean, not only for the family, I mean, anybody who studies history will vouch for the traumatic conditions in North India. We see the movies and we see the photos about one set of people going from India to Pakistan, the other set of people going from Pakistan to India. I don't think anybody had foreseen such an exodus.
Right.
I think it just happened and kept on happening and kept on happening and getting bigger and worse. And until the point where there was such amount of animosity that it was a stage of no return.
Right.
I think the happenings and almost everybody in North India lost somebody or the other within their family.
Yeah.
So the reconciliation just couldn't take place.
Yeah. So you're right when you say that it was traumatic for everybody. But what stands out during that time and after is the spirit of entrepreneurship. That the people who came from what is now Pakistan into India, they actually had to leave everything behind, like your family did. But the way that they were able to build upon what they had with them, which was their spirit of entrepreneurship, and the never, you know, say die attitude. I find that, you know, whenever we talk about the history of India, we kind of overlook the contribution of people who came from across the border and set up businesses, set up new enterprises, and over a period of time actually contributed greatly to the economy. So your father also and your uncle also were part of that entrepreneurs who made actually something from nothing. So how did the business then, did they stay in the same large area that of business that they were in the trucking and, you know, logistics, or did they do something different?
I repeat, Sonu, that the only thing which the inheritors or the entrepreneurial inheritors can really take advantage of is the pioneering spirit.
Yeah.
To case a point, say if I was to go back when I joined business in 1969-1970, a crore rupees was a huge amount of money.
Absolutely.
Today, if I were to give my son a crore rupees, he couldn't do anything with it. He couldn't start a business with a crore rupees. He couldn't find a flat for himself to stay in with a crore rupees. He couldn't find an office to buy for a crore rupees. So every inheritor needs to reinvent himself.
Right.
Because the inflation is going to eat away whatever he inherits, no matter what amount it is. Today it could be $1 billion. I don't believe that $1 billion will be as important, say, 30 years from today as it is today. So if each generation is unable to improvise, and again, to me, is the pioneering spirit.
Right.
So then my father with his two brothers set out shop in India. Unfortunately, my father died fairly young in 1958, and the entire responsibility of raising three siblings fell on the shoulder of my elder brother. He did have some capital, which, as I said, over a period of time depreciates. But he did what he best he could. He had inherited a financing company, a hire purchase financing company, where he would give money on interest to the truckers, because the truckers in those days, you see, the banks were not so efficient. The truckers were not getting loans to buy the trucks. So here was an enterprise which gave loans to the truckers. And he in turn could borrow from the bank, because the bank, he was able to give these securities to the bank in form of landed property, etc.
Right.
So he made money there. Then over a period of time, he found the banks were actually starting to lend money to the truckers. So as a result of which, naturally, when he was borrowing money at 12%, he had to lend higher than 12%, including his overheads, whilst the bank were lending directly to the truckers at 12%. So the good truckers would go to the bank, the bad truckers remained with him, which meant it was not a good business over a period of time. So he decided to cash out, and he bought himself into two iconic properties, one in Delhi called the PVR Plaza Cinema.
At that time it was called Plaza.
The Plaza Cinema.
PVR came much later, I'm
yes.
sure.
And the Minerva Cinema in Bombay. Of course.
So was he very fond of films, or did he just see it as a business opportunity?
Yeah, totally as a business opportunity, because by that time my Chacha Ji had set up the same hire purchase business in Bombay.
Right.
So my Chacha Ji was rubbing shoulders with all the filmmakers, the film actors, Duleep Kumar, Raj Kapoor Ji, and the like. They were in touch with film producers, and one of the big film producers was Mr. F.C. Mehra. And there came this opportunity where Mr. K.K. Modi, who owned a string of cinema halls, wished to disinvest. So the proposal came their way to invest into the Plaza Cinema in Connaught Place, the property of Plaza Cinema, not just the movie hall, as well as the property of Minerva Cinema in Bombay, at a sum of 50 lakhs of rupees. Now again, 50 lakhs of rupees in 1964 was a huge sum of money. So these five people, or initially there were four people, and what I recall, there were
four people. That was your brother.
That was my brother, my Chacha Ji, Mr. F.C. Mehra, and one gentleman called Mr. Gurdyal Singh, who was a wizard at the repairing truck. So they got together and they went in, and they were successful in giving the bid that Mr. Modi wanted. And at an age, they were just about 35 years each at that time. So you can imagine if I was to look at the property value of a Plaza today and Minerva today, say about 200 crores, I can't think of many people who could get together 200 crores at the age of 35. But they came together, and then Mr. F.C. Mehra, of course, proposed that Mr. Shami Kapoor also join the gang of four, which actually became the gang of five. So again, improvising, improving, the pioneering spirit, seeing an opportunity and grabbing it and going forward.
Yeah.
So that's what they did. When I entered business in 1969.
But let me just stop you here. Let me just go back to the time of that Plaza Cinema and Minerva were bought. Wasn't there an interesting story about how money was transferred to each other in the presence of a court, in the presence of a judge?
Yes, yes. That, Sono, is a very interesting story. That Mr. Modi had actually taken loans against these theatres. So actually these theatres were pledged to a third party. I think that was some Nizam something from Hyderabad. Not the Nizam, but somebody from their family. And that is documented in the purchase deed. So now we couldn't make payment to Mr. Modi until he had made payment to his creditors. And the title wouldn't pass to us. So these five people got together and along with Mr. Modi and along with the creditor of Mr. Modi, they approached the court in Bombay to resolve the issue, which the court obliged. So on a given day, at the sum of whatever 30, 40, 50 lakhs of rupees was brought in trunks. You must remember in those days, there were very few 1,000 rupee notes. I'm sure there must have been more in 100 rupee notes, maybe even less. And it must have taken them a considerable amount of time to count them in the court. So actually in the court, the money was taken in cash by these five entrepreneurs, given to Mr. Modi, who in turn transferred, gave it to the creditors. The creditors thereafter signed a deed saying that the property was now free, and Mr. Modi thereafter signed it over to these five gentlemen. Except there was a hitch, there was even more interest in that. That the theatre in Bombay, which was the actual valuable theatre amongst the two, which is the Plaza Cinema, was given on a 10-year lease to 20th Century Fox.
The producers.
The big Hollywood producers. So actually, the even though the property passed in name to these five gentlemen, the key was still with 20th Century Fox. And as per those laws, it was not necessary or incumbent on the tenant to give the property back. They could simply drag on cases, and we could be stuck with no property, no money for years. But these gentlemen did their homework in advance. They had approached 20th Century Fox. They had got the MD of 20th Century Fox in India, a gentleman called Mr. Prabhu, a very, very likable person. I remember meeting him in Bombay. And he asked just for 24 hours to revert back to them what would be the status on the day that the lease expired. After checking with his bosses way back in either New York or Hollywood, I wouldn't know where they bosses sat, but he gave an affirmative nod. He says in his first person scenario said, we are an American company, we carry out what we promised, and we had promised to finish the lease on a certain date, and on that date the key would be given. And true enough, on the midnight of 1964, I think, December, some date, the key was handed over.
And so the property did become
I'm happy to say that December, I think 15th this year, would be 55 years when the key of the property was handed to us. and I'm in touch with the inheritors of the original five people, and we intend to celebrate this year in the summer.
That fascinating story, but you know what stands out is that the cash doesn't leave your family. I mean, it traveled all the way from the Middle East to Peshawar, and then it had to be brought to the court to enable you to buy the property. But after this, you grew up seeing your father in this kind of a business, your uncle in this kind of a business. And then were you also initiated into this family business, or did you want to strike out on your own?
Well, yes, I was initiated into the family business, but not this family business. And as I said, that every generation needs to improve and improvise. I would say that really something which was a hell of a lot of money in those days, I could proudly say that all these five families now, whatever they get from this theater, is just part of what they are making. They are making much more in their individual businesses. For example, the children of Mr. F. Simera, they themselves became very renowned film producers, film directors. Mr. Mehra never did any direction on his own, but his children are very famous film directors. They have directed all the big names from Shah Rukh Khan to Sunny Deol. They've made movies with them. We ourselves went into different businesses. I actually was inducted into a small family business manufacturing furniture. This was started with my bhabhi, my eldest brother's wife, as a hobby, because when she helped my elder brother renovate the Plaza Cinema in 1968, she got a lot of
connections and exposure
into the interiors business. So she had founded a interior decoration company, catering to the residences of well-heeled businessmen. So I joined her. I took it one step further. I started then in the same company, making furniture and doing interiors for five-star hotels.
Right.
So we jointly, during that journey of 15 years, from 1969 for the next, say, 1984-85, we did contracts for Oberoi Hotels in Nepal, Oberoi Hotels, Sri Lanka, the ITDC hotels in Bangalore, and a string of residences and offices for the Modis and Dalmias, who at that time were and still are an aggressive industrial group. So that was, again, improvising and improving. Then
and the way that I look at it is taking the opportunity from where you see it. It was your bhabhi who saw an opportunity and you joined in and you just expanded it. Which, to go back to what you keep referring to as the pioneering spirit or the spirit of entrepreneurship, this is what defines, you know, people at every generation, to see where the opportunities are and make the most of it.
Yeah, Sunu, because there is really no other way. Because if I were to think about a trucking contract in Tehran, that opportunity doesn't exist. If I were to think of getting army disposal dumps anywhere in the world, that opportunity, that business doesn't exist. So the only thing you carry forward with you is the spirit. You may call it the spirit of entrepreneurship or the spirit of pioneering. That's what keeps you moving.
Yeah. So to come back to the furniture business, and then you're dealing with all the hotels, and then there's also the story about how you started importing these specific items that are required in the rooms of hotels.
Yeah, in 15 years, Sonu, I found that this was a very, very personalized business. And wherever I could reach personally, my bills would get passed. Wherever I was not there for a month or so, things would just lapse off. That no, let Mr. Sahni come, we'll discuss it with him, you know. This chair was not supposed to be the way it's come out. The design was different. It was supposed to be 1 inch here and 1 inch there. So I was actually, a whole new world opened to me when I was doing these hotels in Nepal and Sri Lanka, where we were being paid in foreign currency, which means we could import products from anywhere in the world. So we came across various products which had not been introduced to India, starting off with something called the Electrolux minibar. So even though Electrolux had its own company in India or a distribution arm, they were actually selling more kitchen equipment than the minibar. And I found this was a fascinating product because it had no moving parts. That makes it ideal for the hotel bedroom, where a person who's paying a lot of money, he doesn't want sound, and the sound of the compressor going on and off. That's why bedrooms don't really have the normal refrigerators. And in those days, since these minibars were not there, we were using normal refrigerators in the hotel bedrooms, which would make a noise, which would form ice and defrost, and the water would come and
destroy the carpets.
So we carried on that spirit of bringing new products and technologies, and it took me 12 months to sell my first minibar, or the first lot of 250 minibars, to the Oberoi Hotel in Delhi, because it was a new product, it was a new game, and it took time to convince the people that we were one generation ahead of whatever was present. But happily enough, as soon as the Oberois accepted it, then Moria accepted it, then Taj accepted it, and then
every other hotel,
I could probably say that we have put about 150,000 minibars into India.
So you're responsible for a lot of people getting drunk in their hotel rooms.
Well, it's better to get drunk in the hotel rooms than in the discotheque. You know, it costs less money, right, and it costs less
damage.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So from importing minibars to the journey of what you're doing now.
So actually, over a period of time, one of the hotel owners came to us and he said, you know, I'm looking for something called Scotch Guard. So I didn't know what the damn thing Scotch Guard was, except I read the label and it said that it is manufactured by 3M in USA. So we went about contacting 3M in USA, and of course that's 12 hours difference, so when they are awake, we are asleep, and vice versa. But we got through to the correct person. This dear sir, you're contacting wrong people. The people who are looking after 3M products for India are in Singapore. So that made life a lot simpler. So we went to Singapore and we got the agency for 3M to sell Scotch Guard, which we started selling to hotels.
Right.
Then things went forward. 3M.
But just for the benefit of a lot of people who may not know what Scotch Guard is, it is definitely not a form of scotch or whiskey. It's something that protects the fabric and it protects coating.
You're absolutely right. The brand name Scotch was actually used by 3M for their products, including Scotch tape, including in those days we used to have tape recorders with these ribbons, which were also called Scotch spools or whatever. So actually Scotch was something which was a trade name for 3M. So yes, we would spray this onto fabrics used in five-star hotels since they underwent a lot of wear and tear. And we became the first company to import Scotchgard into India. Then thereafter, 3M decided to set up shop in Bangalore and formed a company called Birla 3M. So initially we thought that we would be losing a market share because now they would do it on their own. Except the managing director of the first Birla 3M entity called Will Scrivens, along with his deputy Ajay Nanavati, came to meet us in Delhi to find out how we could import the goddamn thing, because imports were so tough. So I asked him, why should I give you my trade secret? So he said, Mr. Sahni, if you give me your trade secret, you can have any territory, monopoly or in any territory that you're seeking for. So I got the territory of North India and I taught them how to import Scotchgard into the country. Then we carried on with 3M. We distributed professional media cassettes, you know, the things that people use to shoot movies and shoot TV series on.
Pneumatic cassettes.
They were pneumatic, some other names.
Some cassettes.
So the cassette for shooting, then we did some media for them, CDs when digital media came in. So we literally did anything and everything which came our way. Happily enough, today we have six different verticals whereby we distribute, manufacture, give a turnkey solution to six different verticals, as diverse as the hotel industry, as diverse as the footwear manufacturing industry, as diverse as the airport modernization industry. In the meantime, we learned how to cook Italian food, and we have three Italian restaurants, which of course Sono, you've been to them, called Tonino. I'm missing one vertical. We also supply products to the TV broadcast industry and the radio broadcast
industry. So Jaspal, actually, as I listen to your story and I have listened to your conversations earlier, I think there's just one thing that stands out for me, which is the entrepreneurship, the spirit of entrepreneurship, the pioneering spirit, as you call it. Because I think it is actually an inspirational story for a lot of people. We've heard the stories about big business people who have made it big. We know their stories. But there are people like you, your family, and there are a lot of others who've actually lived that spirit of entrepreneurship and virtually have created something, and something is a large thing out of nothing. So here is saluting that spirit of entrepreneurship, and thank you for taking time out and speaking to the listeners of the Inheritors podcast. And it's, as always, pleasure speaking to you. And let me say it once again, you're a great storyteller. Maybe there's a career waiting for you somewhere.
Thank you so much. Since I'm going to retire from my business life very quickly, I'm looking for a job.
The Inheritors podcast series by Bloomberg Quint.
Filter coffee is a fascinating beverage. You need to pick the right beans, blend them in the right proportion, roast them to perfection, and slow brew at the right temperature to get the perfect cup. Which is exactly like great conversations as well. You need to track down the most interesting minds, get them into their zone, and settle down for an unhurried, unscripted chat. And coffee for me is always, always, always best enjoyed with friends. I'm Karthik Nagarajan, and do share my table as I meet some of the most interesting people I know and sit them down for a strong cup of coffee and an even stronger conversation. Join me every Wednesday for a freshly brewed episode. This is not Frappe. This is the Filter Coffee Podcast.